Good afternoon. In several months, the open mine will be 5 years old. And that's getting pretty old, especially for a television program. Like any aging institution, the open mine is beginning to develop traditions. One of our most cherished is that about this time each year, we take a close, hard look at that critical area of American life, civil rights. Where have civil rights been in the ensuing year? Where are we now, and where are they going? To help us make that investigation, our panel, here to my right, Father Donald R. Campion, Associate Editor of the National Catholic Weekly, America. In the center, Mr. Roy Wilkins, an old friend of the Open Mind, Executive Secretary of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And across from me, Mr. Edwin J. Lucas, the well-known attorney, who is Director of the National Affairs Department of the American Jewish Committee. Mr. Lucas, your committee, in the course of its usual publication of an annual review of civil rights called The People Take the Lead, has just brought out its 1961 report. And I notice the opening comment, America's forward thrust toward greater opportunity and equality for all its citizens has maintained a heartening momentum during the past 12 months. Thanks to these tremendous gains, second-class citizenship, based on such extraneous factors as race, religion, and national origin, is on the way out. Mr. Wilkins, as a man who's been very much in the center of this civil rights question, does the optimism of that statement check with your impression?
I think, Mr. Goldman, that it does. I think, in general, the statement is accurate and portrays what took place in 1960. But, of course, it doesn't filter down to the man in the street, and it doesn't help him necessarily buy a home. Just this morning we read, or day before yesterday, in the papers about a restrictive covenant in Washington, D.C., a covenant barring Negroes and Jews and Armenians and Syrians and Persians. Of course, this is contrary to the American tradition. And one might say that as long as this happens, the American Jewish Committee shouldn't say that we're making progress, but I don't agree with that. I think we are making progress.
I think we're making progress. I want to add, having at least in part authored the statement that you read, Mr. Goldman, that progress is slow. It's discouragingly slow. I'm fond of saying, Mr. Wilkins, that it's slow as a glacier, but has none of its majesty or grandeur. I think the resistance is becoming more savage. I think that the pockets of resistance are now hardening. And whereas we have roughly, I think, four or five states that are still segregated, almost completely, three that are completely segregated, I think they're going to be with us for a long, long while. And the reason why it depresses me sometimes to have to say this, although I'm encouraged when I look at the progress that's made, but looking back over my shoulder, I see such creatures as Leander Perez in New Orleans. And I hope I'm not out of order if I suggest that to me he is Leanderthal. And I think that his leadership, the kind of leadership that he's giving to the resisting forces in the South, is the kind of leadership that is going to be difficult to overcome.
Father Campion?
I would agree, I think, certainly with Mr. Wilkins, that it has been a good year. And in that sense, we are both agreeing with Mr. Lucas's evaluation, the American Jewish Committee's evaluation of the year. I'm not sure that I'd be as pessimistic about the rate of progress that we may expect in, as your committee's report suggests, the next decade, in the decade that we're in at the present time. Although I must admit again that I have been disappointed myself. I suppose many of us in 1954 felt a great surge of hope and built up great expectations at the time. I know certainly I did, many of my friends did. And I think what was wrong in our hope in our evaluation of what lay, our estimation rather, what lay ahead, was precisely our failure to realize the sort of savage leadership that the opponents of civil rights would be able to summon up, the effect that they would be able to have. However, when I go back to my other more optimistic side, I think that I would want to introduce the note of education that has taken place among the people who should have provided better leadership up to the present time. and I think who are now beginning to realize some of their mistakes, the fact that a wait-and-see attitude just doesn't work. I think particularly of the New Orleans situation, the school situation there, and I think possibly to some extent maybe particularly of Catholic, Roman Catholic participation in this whole process there. There have been attempts at leadership and some very vigorous forms of leadership at times. On the other hand, possibly too widespread an attitude of wait and see among people, and we realize now that that's impossible.
You mean you're suggesting that you feel that the Catholic leadership itself should be more vigorous?
I believe that states exactly what I wanted to put.
Well, gentlemen, there's something new in this situation, and I'd like to get to it immediately. It has to do with the pitched battle staged a week or 10 days ago against the United Nations by American Negroes. And one of America's most respected journalists, Mr. James Reston in the New York Times, wrote something which I've heard said in a number of quarters. When American Negroes staged a pitched battle against the UN, it is obvious that something is seriously wrong. He goes on to point out that there is in America today not only an anti-Negro racism, but an anti-white racism, led by a small but increasingly powerful sect of black Muslims and other less extreme organizations. And then he goes on to the point which I want to bring into our discussion. He says these are not communist sects, but some of them are putting their race ahead of the nation to the detriment of both. And here's the cruncher. It is not difficult to imagine how any suggestion of race before country would be used by anti-Negro racists to slow down the whole process toward racial desegregation in the U.S.
I think this is a point of view that certainly ought to be explored, Mr. Goldman, but I can't say that I agree wholly with Mr. Reston's analysis of it. I think, first of all, we have to remember that American Negroes have every right to protest a political murder as horrible as the one of Lumumba. And I think we ought to, and especially a man like Reston, ought to understand, I think elsewhere in his column he makes a bow in this direction, that you can't take a segment of American citizens and teach them racism day after day and week after week and year after year. You can't tell them that you can't do this and you mustn't go there and you're denied this because of your race, and then expect them to submerge race and think of country. They have to think of race. Every time they turn around, they're reminded of race. Now, as I've said frequently, Negroes are Americans, first of all. And when the chips are down, in the past, they have always defended America and fought for America and put their country first. And they'll do that in the future, I'm sure. But at the same time, I get a little tired of people saying, well, why do you folks talk about racism? Mr. Reston infers that Negroes have injected racism, and I think some of them have, small. These groups at the UN represented, at their own claim, not more than 500 members. One organization said it had 100 members, and another one said it had 450 members. Well, there are 18 million Negroes in the United States, and these people don't represent American Negroes. They represent themselves. But it would be a mistake to say that they don't represent the sympathy which American Negroes have for the struggles of Africans, because they do have this sympathy. They don't put their race ahead of their country, but they have that sympathy.
This is a long-growing thing, isn't it? I recall studying about the Marcus Garvey movement back in the 1920s. The Negro nationalism in America. But I think Mr. Reston, without passing judgment on it, is trying to suggest that it is becoming a serious block in the way of civil rights for the Negroes.
Well, I don't know. Let's look at that. Take the desegregation of schools. It was ordered by the Supreme Court in 1954. Here we are in 1961, and there's still 2,500,000 Negro children who have not been desegregated. And American Negroes, that's what the sit-ins were all about. American Negroes are getting a little tired of this creeping progress and calling it acceleration or something that they should be glad about. They're not glad about it. They don't like it.
I wondered when I read the account of the demonstration at the UN, whether we weren't witnessing there one of the more dramatic symptoms of the feeling of frustration which the American Negro must feel in the face of what's happening in New Orleans and Athens, Georgia, and elsewhere.
The younger Negroes especially.
I'm not suggesting that anybody would necessarily order this mode of demonstrating that feeling of frustration, nor, looking back over it, whether even the leaders themselves are proud of the demonstration. I don't know. I'm not prepared to pass judgment on that. But I wonder whether we wouldn't be correct in assessing what happened there as one of the signs of frustration which they found expression for in the death of Lumumba.
Well, Father, can
I see that? Yes, I feel that the demonstrations themselves, without attempting to pass a judgment on the extent to which they represent, say, American Negroes, or that percentage of American Negroes may have felt exactly the sentiments that these people expressed or attempted to express publicly there, it certainly would be very understandable. We have tended to deny the American Negro his American-ness, if I might call it that, by denying him certain the things that we give to an American, that we insist are the rights of an American, and yet at the same time now we're expecting to act completely as an American, if I understand Weston's point. On the other hand, I think the problem as far as its impact on the movement to guarantee civil rights to the American Negro would lie in two areas. First of all, the group of the Perezes and so on like that, who are going to use this as just more ammunition, and they'll distort it as they can.
I think that's what Reston is trying to suggest, that it'll be used that way.
But yes. I'm afraid that the other area where possibly harm could be done, we can't after all attempt to deal with the Perez. I think the only thing is to try to isolate him as far as his influence is concerned. But among other people whose mentality is possibly on the fence, so to speak, whether or not this might have a harmful effect is something we have to address ourselves to, and I think certainly it has to be explained to them. Something should be done to explain to them just exactly what is involved here, that this isn't an attempt to deny an American sentiment among the Negroes necessarily and by any means, but simply a very understandable identification with peoples in other lands who are suffering.
I think, Father Campion, you're right. I think the damage will be not among the Perezes, because they've already expressed themselves on this question that the African situation will not influence them. But on the people who haven't made up their minds or who are inclined to be fair, and they hold up and say, well, we can't afford to endorse this sort of thing. I don't think very many, Mr. Lucas, I don't think very many American Negroes are proud of the demonstration at the UN.
I'm sure not.
And I think probably the leaders of those, Mr. Goldman, may be a little ashamed now. And after all, they don't want the distinction. I mean, now, American Negroes don't want the distinction of staging the most disorderly, the most rowdy, the crudest demonstration ever in the history of the United Nations.
Well, the crudest since Khrushchev, you mean.
Well, yes, but Khrushchev, of course, pounded his shoe on the table, and that's for a head of state. This was the nadir of behavior. But American Negro citizens don't want the reputation to go down in history that they staged the worst disorder at the UN.
Mr. Wilkins, may I stay with this point for just one moment more, because I'm sure so many of our viewers are interested in it. I detect in all of the statements of you men the explanation of why the Negro feels this frustration, an explanation, of course, which all of us can understand and sympathize with. But is there implicit in this the assumption that if the Negro continues to feel frustration with the snail-like pace of desegregation, that we are going to see the rapid growth of this kind of black nationalism, which, if I understand it, Mr. Wilkham, stands for the exact opposite of what the NAACP stands for?
Yes.
The NAACP wants to bring the American into full equality.
Yes.
They want to...
Well, this is really one of the dilemmas confronting both American Negroes and Africans. You know, we don't see eye to eye with the Africans necessarily. Here in this country, they don't feel that the American Negro is so much, and they rather decry his goal of integration into American democracy. They want him to be separatist and racist. Well, they have a different motivation. In their country, they want their country back. They want their land back. And they are the vast majority there, and they want to control it politically and geographically and economically. The American Negro is a minority here, and this is his country. He's been this way ever since 1619. He wants to be and is an American, and he's having difficulty adjusting himself to this land black nationalism. He can understand it, but you scratch him very deeply, and you find 7th Avenue in New York, or you find South Parkway in Chicago, or you find Beale Street in Memphis, and these are the terms in which he thinks.
Well, is your answer to the question whether frustration is going to increase this kind of extreme black nationalism that one simply can't tell?
I think it, if we have continued iron and rigid proscription of the Negro with no progress whatsoever, or with so small progress that he can't count it, then I think this sort of feeling is going to grow with him, and the sympathy is going to increase.
Much of that is to be found in the literature of the nationalist movement, actually. It parades itself as the only movement that will satisfy the aspirations of the American Negro. That this far the American Negro has gone and no further can he go.
Right.
And therefore this becomes the refuge of the disillusioned, depressed, deprived Negro. Of course, it isn't true, but my point is that they are smart enough, they're shrewd enough to be able to use that as an attraction.
I suspect, too, that as far as the impact on other countries of what's happening over here is concerned, the American Negro will probably have to explain to Africans living, say, in Europe and so on, the motivation behind the attitude that I think, say, your association, Mr. Wilkins, would attempt to foster what it expects from the American Negro here, because I think it's an understandable sort of thing. The African would look over here and say, I see people who came from my land and they still have ties, those deep ties that any people would feel with their brothers anywhere, and they expect possibly something which we just can't give. The American Negro wouldn't be able to give, and I think it's been true of so many other groups in this country here. It's a problem that arises periodically, I know, among any number of immigrant groups from European countries that has arisen. Where you draw the line between a loyal identification with older ties, yeah. But in this case here, of course, it's complicated by the other factors of an international crisis.
Father Campion, may I use this theme of the results of frustration to move us, of course our time rushes on, to a problem connected with the Catholic in America. Some of my colleagues, knowing that we were going to have this program, suggested, and I agree with them, that it would be interesting to have your comment on this, whether there is a feeling of frustration growing with respect to the Catholic community and the issue of aid to the schools, which has become so serious, the question of aid to parochial schools, that the Catholic in America feels that it's almost a civil rights problem, that he is having a fundamental right denied him. I looked up for this purpose Cardinal Spellman's remarks, and here he actually uses the word. He says, by denying this measure of equality to church-related school children and their parents, the task force proposals, that is Kennedy's, are blatantly discriminating against Catholics. This is the language of civil rights, isn't it?
I believe that you've hit on a very interesting development that has taken place in American Catholic thinking, as I see it. For some years now, I know one Catholic spokesman, well-known Catholic spokesman, Father John Courtney Murray, has described the problem as he sees it in those terms precisely. He feels that the Americans outside of the Catholic community haven't really appreciated the sense of inequity that many Catholics feel. And I think particularly of the Catholic parent, because they're the ones who feel this in the pocketbook, where sometimes feelings can be particularly acute. And I think that what Cardinal Spellman has attempted to speak now is to speak really out on that problem. And I think the language, as you suggest, is precisely assuming that form. I've heard people say that, summoning American Catholic parents to adopt the attitude that the American Negro has had, to present intelligently, calmly, to argue on the basis of reason, and to appeal to the sense of fair play on the part of other Americans, to recognize that this is a disability, an imposition, whatever you want to call it, that they feel is becoming increasingly, and I think that's the particular point. That
this is what's new in it, isn't it?
Yes,
this growing feeling?
It's growing more impossible because of the situation they are there. Now, whether or not there are going to be also periods in which they're going to have to understand themselves, the American Catholic community themselves, that this is a complex situation, and that there often may be a series, a set of complex of rights that are involved here that have to be balanced off. That, I feel myself, will be the area of solution, or the mode of solution eventually, will be to see that and to work out some sort of a compromise, whatever you want to call it.
Mr. Lucas, I got you.
I don't think, Mr. Goldman, that the use of the word discrimination in the context of Cardinal Spellman's statement on the subject of aid to parochial schools is civil rights language at all.
You know, not even emotionally.
It may be. I wouldn't want to pass judgment on that, but I don't think it's civil rights language in the legal sense. I think that what he was talking about there and what the Catholics, with all respect, Father Campion, talk about when they speak of discrimination against the parochial schools is that certain forms of aid are given to certain types of educational institutions and withheld from others. And they would speak of this as discrimination in the sense that a preference is being given to one type of aid and withheld on another level. Now, this argument has been made before, and I imagine will continue to be made during this battle over the church-state separation doctrine. And I suspect that in the Rockefeller plan in New York, as well as in the bill that will be offered Congress soon on the subject of aid to education, will heighten and dramatize this dispute. But this discrimination is a vastly different kind from the discrimination we've been talking about earlier in the program.
Yes, I think that's true, Mr. Lucas, but it's hard, as Mr. Goldman has suggested, to separate it emotionally in the consideration of this problem. The Negro community views the efforts, Rockefeller proposal, for example, and a number of other proposals for state aid, and I use state in its broadest sense, to private schools or parochial schools, but private takes in all of them, as a development that might further slow down the desegregation of the public schools.
And we've
expressed our concern to Governor Rockefeller, because if it is established as an accepted practice that state funds shall go to private schools, there is nothing to prevent the states in the South who intend to resist to the last from setting up private schools and claiming state aid for them. Now, since the Negro has little or no political influence within those states themselves in state elections, he would have no control, even that control that comes at the ballot box, which sometimes is a tenuous business. He would have no control over the allocation of these monies from the state treasury.
Well, that's very much the point I wanted to bring out before when I spoke of this complex of possibly conflicting rights, or at least rights that can't all be satisfied equally at one and the same moment. I'm very much aware of that problem. That's been a concern of mine, I recall, even from 1954 on, and it's particularly the thing I was gratified to see the other day, the statement of the two bishops of Georgia, the Roman Catholic bishops of Georgia and of one in North South Carolina, making it very clear that certainly there would be no segregation in the Catholic schools beyond certainly any date at which public schools were integrated there. That, I think, has to be made very clear, but it's the problem, I think, which is feel, and I feel possibly whether or not it is technically civil rights language, the important thing is what is felt here and what you bring up, Mr. Goldman, that question of the emotional content. W.I. Thomas so well said, the definition of the situation is the important thing. If a person feels it's real, that's a fact that has to be taken into consideration.
Gentlemen, the time is slipping through my hands. It always does on an interesting program. And we have about 4 or 5 minutes left. Mr. Lucas, with respect to the Jewish community, I have the feeling the Negro community is in great ferment about civil rights issues. There are these other issues, civil rights are not akin to them, ferment in the Catholic community. And I have a feeling, looking through the literature, that the Jewish community is rather satisfied.
Satisfied with what?
The civil rights situation.
Oh, no. First of all, let me make this clear.
I don't mean the civil rights situation with respect to the Negro and the Catholic. I mean with respect to themselves.
Oh, I've misunderstood.
With respect to Jewish.
Well, as to the other, I do want to say this, that it is by now clear and firm that it would be literally impossible, even if it were desirable, which it is not, for the Jew to identify with the civil rights problem largely in Jewish terms. It couldn't be done, quite apart from the fact that it shouldn't be done. It couldn't be done because it is impossible, legally, culturally, educationally, or otherwise, to satisfy or protect or preserve or secure the rights of one minority group without doing likewise for all other minority groups. But as to the status of the
Jews. Yes, well, let me be very clear. I know that the Jewish organizations are very concerned with the rights of the Negroes and the Catholics, but what about their own rights?
Well, they are equally concerned about their own rights.
Are they worried about anything?
Of course.
Especially? What?
Of course. Show me a Jew who doesn't worry, Mr. Goldman.
Well, most of the reports are rather self-congratulatory. For example, take this one of the Anti-Defamation League. The number of Jewish students admitted to medical colleges, 19% up in 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so there's a tone of satisfaction about
a tone of gratification. Yes. Let me say this to you. 20 years ago, it was almost literally impossible, 25, 30 years ago, a correction, almost literally impossible for a young Jewish hopeful aspiring to medical education to get such a medical education in this country. Many of the physicians who are practicing today, Jewish physicians, secured their education in part in the South and in part abroad. Many of them went to Germany in the days when it was safe to go to Germany, to Vienna, to France, to England, to secure their medical education. Today, that situation has changed considerably. And all that's being said here, for leaving the arithmetic of it to one side, is that there has been this enormous improvement, and gratifying improvement. But as for satisfaction, it is today impossible, almost literally impossible, for a Jew to rise above the line of lawyer, researcher, scientist, economist, in the vast majority of big business and industry today.
Would you say that's the problem which now most concerns Jews, the rise in big industry?
No.
Have the professions been conquered and opened, and business is the issue?
As to the first part of your question, I should say not. That is not, it's a concern, but it's a concern that's symbolic. It's symbolic of the fact that in many areas of human life today in this country, Jews have been reduced to second-class citizenship. And there's a relationship, a relatedness between his ability to rise in business and his ability to become eligible for membership in a club, let us say. The exclusion in the one is usually followed by the exclusion in the other. Now, the second part of your question, I want to say that there are many other areas, quite apart from business and industry. I don't feel too unhappy about a person who can't become a vice president of a corporation, except for the symbol that it represents. But in many, many residential areas of big cities, Jews cannot buy homes. Their children cannot enter certain types of private schools. And in many, many places, it would be impossible for a Jewish child to make any friends, meaningful friendships, because of prejudice of their parents and because of the place in which they live.
We're very close to the end. Let me get just one thing clear. You feel that there are all these issues in Jews' minds. Do you think they are there as intensely as the issues are in the Negro mind and the Catholic mind?
I think not, for one very good reason, and that is that the Jew has made slightly more progress in the years that he's been here. And the type of prejudice that is exhibited against...
I'm sorry, I do have the cutoff signal for this discussion. Thank you very much, Father Donald Campion, Mr. Roy Wilkins, and Mr. Edwin J. Lucas. Good afternoon. Rushes away.
WNBC-TV has just presented The Open Mind. Your host on The Open Mind was Eric F. Goldman, professor of history at Princeton University. Professor Goldman's guests today were Roy Wilkins, Father Donald Campion, and Edwin J. Lucas. If you have any comments or questions on today's program, or if you have any suggestions for future programs, please send them to The Open Mind, WNBC-TV, New York 20, New York.